But could it really be so?
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
This episode is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program.
Hello, everybody. I am the Orca Man, Fred, and today I am here with Salma. Salma is a Sightings Network coordinator and data and GIS analyst for the Whale Museum, who I've been in contact with. How long have you been in touch? Like 2 years now, I think?
I always, when I talk about you to people, I always say, like, you started emailing me as soon as I got hired. Never hired. Yeah.
When did you get hired?
I started like very end. I sometimes don't even feel like it qualifies because my first day was like December 27th, 2019. And then it was like, okay, you have the next few days off for New Year. So it's like December, January. What is 2020 anymore? But yeah, somewhere in there.
Well, you also entered then right at the beginning of COVID.
Yeah.
You're like 2 months.
Yeah, I started right before the world decided to go upside down. Yes.
So fun.
Yeah.
And when in that process, when did you end up going to the San Juan Island?
So it's kind of like I already knew that I was going to be moving up there in like October-ish. Jenny, who's the executive director of the Whale Museum, and I have been talking about getting the funds together to create my position. And then in like October, it kind of happened, like the stars aligned and I had to cut off a lease and I was tutoring kids at the time in the Bay Area. And so I had to take my kids through the rest of the semester and kind of just like get my things all in line and, you know, drive a giant moving truck from Oakland up to Anacortes and then get on like the ferry and then show up on this island. So yeah, like I knew about it for a couple months before I actually moved up there. But then like I didn't really like set foot on the island as the Sightings Network coordinator until like end of December.
Wild. I was going to say, because I can only, like, one of the biggest things during the whole pandemic that I can remember is like sitting here and trying to decide where I wanted to stay during it. And I was like, okay, like, is it here? Is it back home or otherwise? But being on an island for the whole of it, I actually really didn't think about that until right now. Like, that makes a big difference.
Yeah, it honestly, okay, I don't know if I'm going to get like crap this, but like, I was so thankful that I was on this island for the pandemic because, like, don't get me wrong, I loved Oakland, but living in Oakland was hard. And I mean, I'm from like a city area. I'm from the DC metro area. And even then, like, living in Oakland was just like between like just like Bay Area prices and then also like, you know, constantly having to worry about street sweeping or like, you know, like your car windows getting smashed in. Like I had a license plate stolen off my car. And it was just like, you know, add all to that, like, you know, just like germy people. I think I would have lost my absolute mind living in like any city, but like just Oakland specifically, because that's where I was at beforehand. So I was very thankful to be on an island. Very, very thankful to be on an island for the quarantine.
I was going to say, with like a whole like 3,000 people who you probably ended up like recognizing by the end of it too. Like, it's one of the things about it. Like, it's so small.
Like, I never left my house. No. I never left my house. No. I got groceries delivered. I was that person. I just honestly, it just like messed me up in the head because I was just like, people were like, it's the flu, but then we just didn't know anything about it. And I was just like, you know what? I'm 26, 27. I'm not that anymore. But like, I'm not interested in getting like heart disease for the rest of my life or like lung disease for the rest of my life. So I was very much like keeping my butt at home. Like, that's it.
Yeah. It's a good way to be out of it. So earlier when you were saying you were like getting ready to go over, you said you and Jenny were talking about like creating your position.
Yeah.
So
okay.
Did it exist? How did that come about?
It didn't exist as a standalone like position. It was always kind of like an add-on. And before me, it was Jennifer Olson, who is now a faculty member at Everett Community College. She works with the Ocean Research, ORCA, like the acronym is ORCA. It's Ocean Research Conservation Academy or something like that. Cool. I'm gonna mess that up, but it's part of the Everett Everett Community College like system, and I think it's for like high school students that are taking you know, like college level classes before they actually graduate and things like that. Yeah. Anyway, so Jen was the Stranding Network coordinator and the Sightings Network coordinator.
Okay.
And also a lot of other things. She was a curator at one point. So Jen did everything.
Yeah, and, she's all over the place.
Yeah, so it was kind of like from Jen, like butted three individual positions. And I think I'm one of the most like recent ones because the curator was kind of, had butted off, if you will, from Jen a couple years before me. And there was always a curator, at least a couple years prior to my starting. But so the Sightings Network was the last thing that kind of butted off of Jen. And Alyssa Scott, who is now the Sightings Network, Stranding Network coordinator.
Yeah.
At the Whale Museum. Yeah, so that's good. Did I answer that question?
Yeah, I'd say so. So when Jen left, they needed people for the Stranding Network, Sightings Network, and then the curator position is kind of moved around. Dealing with the Sightings Network, and like I can say this pretty sincerely, I don't think I've ever seen a data or GIS analyst as a position at the Whale Museum ever.
No.
So that was also something that was like built up.
Well, I think it was kind of like, I should give Jenny full credit for that because I just happened to be in the right place in the right time. It's not like I was like plotting over here. Jen, so the story kind of starts off like a few months prior to me even just like finding out about this position. And so it was like this Jen Olson was moving on and to her current role now with ORCA. And her stranding position was like advertised on Marmam and all those things. And I was an intern. I was on a Jen, I think that was actually Jen's first intern, stranding intern. I'm just like, yay. I love Jen so much. She's great.
Hell yeah.
So I was an intern back in 2015 at the Whale Museum, and I was like the Stranding Network intern. And so when her position was open and I had just finished my master's at the time, I was like, oh, this is perfect. And unfortunately I didn't get that, and I was bummed out about it, but it turned out that Jenny had ulterior motives for like me, because after I kind of got that like news that sorry, but thanks, but no thanks, like you're not the best fit for Stranding Network position. She came, I had just come back actually from a field trip in Vietnam with my graduate advisor. And Jenny was just like, so I've been talking to WDFW and like Noah or whomever that ended up like, I know where my grants are, but and I think we can get the money together. And I'd really like to have a GIS person be the Sightings Network coordinator, because she really wanted that skill built up at the museum. So that was kind of like Jenny's whole thinking, because she interviewed for the stranding position. I mentioned that I had just finished my master's in GIS, and she was like, oh, you don't say.
we have a different place.
Yes. And obviously I didn't know that, like I had just gotten the news like, hey, sorry, we're not gonna go with you. I was kind of bummed.
Once you finished your master's and you get settled on the island, COVID starts, whatever, what did you kind of walk into for projects with the position? What are the first couple of things they threw at you?
Yeah, so I inherited a couple things, and a couple things were like new for the role. So one of the big things that I inherited was the Orca Master contract report that we do in conjunction with the National Marine Fisheries Science Center. And that is a big annual report that compiles all reported southern resident killer whale sightings that mm-hmm. have been submitted to the Whale Museum, either through our immediate channels or through partnerships that we have with other organizations, and putting together all those data for the year and putting them together in this report with all these like figures and maps. Maps. This is why the GIS thing keeps coming back. It's like, it's not like I just happen to be in the right place in the right time for that. So that's the big contract report. And that honestly does, I think about that every day, the whole year. So like ad infinitum. That's just because it's like the primary support that, you know, makes my position possible. Mm-hmm. And there was also the couple things that were new to me were working with WDFW to kind of help support the RAS initiative. And I don't know if you've heard much about that.
No, I haven't.
So RAS stands for the Whale Report Alert System. And this is one small part of the big ECHO project that was spearheaded by like the Vancouver Port Authority. And it's a BC program. ECHO is a BC program.
Yeah.
excuse me, in 2019, in October, Jenny and I were first talking about like the possibility of creating this position. She invited me up to Seattle as part of like the governor's Orca task force.
Yeah.
To talk about like the impacts of large commercial shipping activity on marine mammals, specifically resident killer whales, because they are so endangered. That's where I kind of got like started getting my footing into the like second hat. Primary hat that I wear in my job, which is supporting the RAS and building up its use in Washington state water. So up until Quiet Sound was created, it was always called ECHO South. And now it's actually called Quiet Sound, which is the ECHO equivalent. Sorry.
You're good.
Which is the ECHO equivalent in Washington state waters. And it encompasses a lot of different things. The one component that I'm actually working on a part of is the RAS initiative. And that is to support the RAS, we ultimately have to support, you know, like sightings data entry. And right now, the only way by which you can submit sightings data to feed into the RAS is through the Whale Report app, which is, which is the public facing side of that application. So I've been working with the BC Cetacean Sightings Network. Well, technically ocean-wise, I work with the BC Cetacean Sightings Network when I'm asking as the Sightings Network coordinator, but then when I'm working with them for the RAS stuff, I'm working with ocean-wise. So again, small nonprofits, so things kind of get like it's the same people. So that's why those two big stuff. So I work with Dr. Lauren Dares and Jessica Scott up at OceanWise with OceanWise.
That's really cool.
Lauren
Terrace gave me this book.
Cool. That's awesome.
I didn't realize that you guys were that close. I worked that closely together. No, that one was what is it? It was Operation Orca, because it was written by Lance Barrett Leonard. He was one of the authors, I'm pretty sure.
Nope, Francis and Hewlett. I lied. Lansbury letter is just in it,
but no, besides the point, that's the cross-boundary collaboration there is huge. That's amazing.
So that was a really cool project and initiative to just like be brought into like from the beginning. It has been, because of COVID, it has been pretty just because a bunch of meetings and a bunch of work that we were all planning on doing to kind of like spread awareness about like the RAS and Whale Report and communicating with, you know, like Whale Museum members and things like that. Definitely. Like everything kind of was just like slowed down by the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So that's not to say that this is, you know, totally, but it's just been a lot slower than I think anyone was kind of like hoping for.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, also too, when everything's when COVID happens too, with that, like not only is the collaboration a little bit harder, but also too, like nobody's out.
Yes. Yeah. There's just, like no one going out. So it's
this is like the sightings have to be like extremely lower than previous years, I'd imagine the past two.
It's funny that it's not.
Really?
Yeah. So, there was definitely like, I was expecting, so when my interns were entering data for me in the beginning of 2020 data, things were a little quiet. And then by April, May, June, there really wasn't a difference in like pre-COVID years and post-COVID years.
When the people who were going to pay attention to see whether or not they were here, they were doing the same stuff. At the end of the day then.
Yeah. And then I would even say like, and this is all anecdotal, right? Like I haven't like sat there and like counted specifically. Yeah. It just seems that way just based on like the sheer number of like pages of data that have been entered. Yeah. And so it's just like, I really think that because of COVID and all of the like, you know, group restrictions and gathering restrictions and things like that, that people were able to do things like renting a boat on their own instead of maybe going out on a whale watch, going out and whale watching on their own. This is me speculating. So I would like just, I don't know, I think actually because people couldn't like gather inside safe anymore, they were doing way more outdoor activities in, you know, the San Juans. A lot of that involves whale watching.
Yeah. And also even if you're just on the coastline at all, like there's a better chance. If you're hanging out on the coastline for a week, like you're going to have your eyes out at the least. And if you come across anybody else, hey, put it into the sightings network X, Y, or Z.
Exactly. Yeah. And I would actually, I didn't even think about that. Like a bunch of people like started road tripping more, right? Like during the pandemic, and like I wouldn't even say we're after the pandemic anymore, but like now people road trip just a lot more. And so I think you're getting a lot. I don't think like sightings have actually taken as big of a hit as people might think that they did.
That's pretty nice then.
Yeah for sure. But that gets into other issues of like, are all of these people who are more or less like out of counters, right? They educated in like the best practices is how to interact with and like view wildlife safely for both them and the wildlife. I don't know, but that is not my, that's not my area.
I was going to say, changing ecosystem, somebody else can go and look at that.
Yeah, I was just like, I am not about to wade into that mess. Like I'm not doing this.
It's its own beast. To say the least. No, that makes all the sense in the world. So you working across border, it comes with a lot of challenges in a number of ways. Even I had to, if I would imagine, the kind of like systems in place for gathering sightings data in BC and the States are not the same. So BC, they have the Whale Report app. Does that cross over to like Washington?
Yeah, you can definitely download it and use the app if you're not in BC waters. So that's not like the apps are not restricted geographically. Okay. The only thing that is restricted is people's movements.
That much is fair.
Yeah. Because the animals are also hopefully like not being restricted by the border.
that would be the biggest goal.
So I think the apps work just fine in DC and waters. And that was the whole kind of point behind this like collaborative effort, is to not reinvent the wheel and, you know, use a pre-existing tool that, you know, was already painstakingly created.
Yeah.
Which in this case is the RAS, to get people on board in Washington State and to kind of like build it up and, you know, use it to actually inform mariners of nearby animals in the area.
Yeah. So even I'm going to ask you to expand upon that just a little bit further too, because the Water Report Alert System, I actually have an idea of what it is, if only because like, I talked to the one days before and I've looked before. Yeah. No, but if you could,
I got that would be excellent. Yeah. So the Whale Report Alert System is a tool that is only for like mariners that operate large commercial shipping vessels. So what that means is like tankers, cargo ships, the ferries. It excludes smaller commercial vessels like whale watch operators, and it also excludes small recreational like private vessels and things like that, and like charter boats and things like that. So it's geared specifically towards large commercial shipping activity. I don't have like the picture stuff of like how, I think you should actually invite like Jessica Scott or like Lauren Dares to come on to your show and talk more about it, because they definitely have to do a really great job communicating their tool. I also, this is a podcast, so people can't see anything anyway. But yeah, so it's so the tool, basically it's like a map that like an operator of a large commercial ship can access either through a desktop app, and the mobile version is it's not the most reliable, because if you're operating large vessels like that, you're not actually allowed to have your phone with you. So there is like a desktop app for the RAS and things like that. But you can basically, as an operator, you can like zoom into, you can pick like your zone of interest that say you'll be like navigating through or transiting through, and it will populate any live sightings in the area, and it'll kind of like, and these sightings kind of like drop off in time based on the species. So for example, if it's a killer whale sighting in zone one, like I think killer whales, like their sightings remain active on the map for like an hour or so, because they don't really hang out very long unless, you know, they're repeated sightings. Definitely. Humpback whale, probably like 6 to 12 hours, and like a larger whale, like, I don't know, like a gray whale or a minke, might be around for like 12 to 24 hours. So I don't fully remember like how those sightings were like stratified, but so that's basically the premise of it. And that's because especially like the problem of shipping is not going away. The problems of shipping activity and the impacts of shipping activities on specifically but you can argue the entire aquatic environment, like marine environment, are only going to, get bigger and more problematic than they already are. And so this is a tool that we can help mitigate the negative impacts of these few, like negative impacts that these shipping activities have on marine mammals. So it's like specifically like noise reduction and speed reduction to avoid like ship strike collision, more than the noise reduction. Slowing down does reduce noise, but I think it's like mitigating the impacts of ship strike is the primary of this.
Well, yeah, ships are also so incredibly large that if you're not actively paying attention, it could be very, very easy to miss that kind of stuff.
For most,
how high they are and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, most large ships don't even know that they've hit. Like, you think of a blue whale as like this is the largest animal that has ever lived, like period, bigger than any dinosaur, bigger than any other living organism that we're aware of, the fossil record, or that is currently or that's extant. And they are so small thanks to these giant like ships, and it's crazy. And most ships won't know that they've hit a whale until they come into port, and then they see that there's an animal like just strewn across their bow. Like that's, and even then that's not, that doesn't always happen. So they don't even feel like a bump in the road, if you will.
No.
It's like sometimes like the animal will get hit and then it will just like sink to the bottom because of its injuries. Sometimes it will strand. Yeah. And then, you know, if it's close enough to like a population center, if the currents are favorable. But yeah, most ship strikes go wildly unreported because they're mostly undetected. Like,
yeah, I was gonna say, it's you can't, no, you can't possibly, with the infrastructure that's been created for them, you can't, there's nothing that was like put in to even try, at the least. And also too, like, yeah, the size of them, they, yeah, with regard, yeah, to like people not understanding, I even, because I live in Vancouver, and down in like Burrard Inlet, there's like anywhere between 10 to 15 like huge cargo ships or tankers that will hang out all the time. And even walking down, like from the beach, they look incredibly massive. And the stretch from here, like the body of water of Burrard Inlet from like North Vancouver to like Kitsilano where I am, it's like 5 to 6 miles. And oh, the, wow, like, yeah, the boats though that are like 75% of the way, like closer to North Vancouver, they still look absolutely massive.
Yeah.
Like it is ridiculous. It's the it's the closest that I think I've ever been to like actually seeing them consistently. Cause people might see like small boats or things like that in coastal communities. But I know Vancouver, at least like this port, is one of the only ones where I've been able to like even kind of conceptualize how large these things actually are.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, if you want to take Vancouver and like multiply it by like at least 10, yeah, up and down the entire like North American West Coast, like, because people don't realize like how much shipping activity is occurring on the West Coast of North America. It's like, mm-hmm, okay, you have Vancouver, and then right below that you have Seattle, and then you go down a little bit, you might have, I think you definitely have a couple like near Portland, I don't know. Oregon's weird. I don't know much about Oregon. This sounds bad. But then you go down to California, you have like San Francisco Bay, and then you also have like Los Angeles. It's just like you have these massive, massive population centers that are accompanied by these massive like ports. And that literally is like, I would hazard a guess, like a good percentage of like the global like shipping activity is coming in and out of just the North American West Coast. And it's like, yeah, you know, a few, maybe like 5 to 10 major ports, but like
they're working. Yeah. Cause especially too, not only does it go up and down, it like, it goes across the Pacific. Like it goes up into Alaska to Russia. I know for guaranteed to a bunch of places in Oceania. Asia, like guaranteed.
Yeah. That's, I mean, like, if you just like want to keep expanding, like the magnifying glass, if you will, right? Like,
oh, yeah,
if you want to go up into like near Alaska and Russia, like you, then you have all that shipping activity for like oil exploration and things like that. It's just like the problem of the impacts of shipping are like inherently global because these ships are like
everywhere,
literally like crossing entire basins in periods of time that are like were once incomprehensible to like mankind, and now we're just like how do you think you have your 2-day shipping from Amazon, right? Like, come on.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely insane. Wild. I didn't think about it. I'd want to talk, because the thing that I forget a lot of the time too is like the process for 2-day shipping, where does it go? Who are the people that touch it? How many hands did it pass through from the start to the end? But also too, like, I couldn't imagine working on one of those. Like being on a ship the size of a city going like through the Alaskan, it's not tundra, tundra's land, but going through like the Pacific Ocean, like that's not a cruise ship.
No. Yeah, no, it's just like, I just don't, it's like the problems that we have now, sometimes I get like really overwhelmed because I'm just like, okay, yeah, we're like looking at like the impact of ship strikes on large marine mammals. And then like you keep pulling, like what we just did, right?
You just extrapolate.
class, and you're like, oh, and you're like, the problem's way more complex to the point where you're like, this isn't even the problem that I was working on. So it's helpful to kind of like expand out and like think about like the broader context in which you're like operating. But it's also important to remember, like, you're one individual and you're trying to tackle like one problem. And even then, within one problem, you're not trying to fix the whole thing. You're trying to do like a wee itty bitty thing. And they're like, that's fine, because there are people all over the place, like all over the world, country, whatever, right?
Yeah.
That are also working on the other little bits of the problem that you can't work on. So it's fine. But
Well, that's also the nice part about having as many people as we are, like, working in these areas. It's like, no one person can do everything at all. Even
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's nonprofit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
UBC's Museum of Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of Indigenous art from around the world, and guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
For anybody who doesn't know, I actually recently went down to Friday Harbor like four weeks ago. A while back, October sometime.
What is time? No one knows.
Long time. But that was like, I have to say, like, I was like, even driving home from that trip, it was kind of surreal because I had been to the Whale Museum actually a year before you were there in 2015, because I was there in 2014 for like a week.
Cool.
And I can remember like being in the San Juan Islands like as a kid. Like as much as I was like, I think 15 at the time, it was like me and my dad going around like trying to see whales any chance we could and stuff like that. But even like walking in as an adult now, being like, oh no, like I like having conversations with you, and then I actually ran into Gloria and Tori from Coextinction on my way out as well. They were like coming on. It's wonderful to like walk into the community, and also too, the community's getting younger, I've seen too.
Yeah, like on Friday specifically, or just like marine mammals?
Well, the people that are working with marine mammals and like entering into kind of the sphere, even like when I was initially looking, when you look at, like, when you think about the researchers, I usually think about like 60 and 50 year olds.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, definitely. I think like Yeah, so I think it's definitely like the demographics of marine mammal conservation practitioners are starting to shift a little. And it's going to depend on who you ask. Because if you talk to someone like me, I'm like, the shift isn't that great. It's not that distinct. But if you talk to someone like who's an old timer, they're going to be like, oh, whoa, yeah, that's a big shift, right? So I think as a whole, the marine mammal field is getting younger. It's a lot more female than it used to be. Definitely, if you look into higher positions, like staff scientists and like, you know, career researchers, you're still going to get your breakdown of like older men, but the field as a whole is still very white. So that's why if you talk to someone like me, they're gonna be like, I don't really see a difference. You know, it's just like the same thing, just slightly different. And so I'm hoping that like maybe I can start kind of like changing things a little.
Definitely
not by being super, I don't know, like how to change, just by like existing, I guess, in this space, like doing work. Not by any sort of like, because scientists do, the minute that you start talking about like identity politics, or you start talking about like changes in like the demographics of practitioners in a particular field, as they start to change, people start getting like really touchy, and they say like, you're not doing activism, like you're trying to be a scientist, right? And so they kind of like dismiss that, but it's like, for someone like me, the two are like inextricably linked, right? It's like, I cannot do science outside of my identity, because I am my identity. And so I think the field overall is getting younger. I'm really excited by that. I really hope it is younger and more progressive, and like a little more, I guess a little less exclusionary, because it's always just felt like very, like a old boys club or something, whatever you want to call it. I'm really bad with my American euphemisms. I think as a whole, marine mammal field is definitely getting younger. I don't really know. I think Friday Harbor definitely is changing, because like I was actually there in 2014. I was not doing any marine mammal stuff. I was working on sand dollars. I was working on the development of like sand dollars at the Friday Harbor Labs with my undergrad advisor, John Allen.
Yeah, nice.
And it's just like, it's definitely changed a lot since like I first stepped foot on Friday Harbor back in 2014. But at least to me, I just, again, and it could definitely, like perspective is relative, right? And to me, it doesn't seem to have changed that much. Yeah.
To the extent.
There's definitely inklings of little things. Like there's a really hip wine bar, where around the corner from where I live. And there's a really awesome sushi place called Rolling Sushi that I love. But
it's touching, especially in a place like Friday Harbor, where it's like the turnover on the island, I don't imagine is terribly much.
I would say turnover is pretty high, just because by virtue of like living on the island, it's a very seasonal place to live.
Yeah.
So I don't think, I think you definitely get your like long-term year-round residents that stay there, and there are definitely old timers. But I think for the most part, like the islands just generally have like a high turnover of residents, just because of like the seasonal nature.
The seasonality.
Yeah.
That's fair. With regard to demographics, is there anything that you've seen that you have been, that has made you hopeful?
I want to I feel like I can't comment on like the broader community that I live in, but for sure. Yeah, I think we have a really great team of people at the museum. We recently, we had a really a burst of hires, and that started in August 2019 with Alyssa as the new stranding coordinator, and then myself in December as the signings network coordinator. Alana Fain came on in March, so you thought I started in the pandemic, you started in the thick of it. Alana Frain took over the Soundwatch voter education program. in March of 2020. And then just this last like April, we hired Melody Smith, who is our new curator. And like, we're all in our 20s, and like Melody has a degree in museology, right? Like, I don't think the museum has ever had a curator that has a master's degree in museology before. And so I think if you want to talk about like, you know, having a data and a GIS analyst on staff, it's just like, now we have like a kick-ass curator with like a degree in like what she's supposed to be doing, right?
Yeah, 100%.
And so I think like, I feel that the museum is really set up to do some really awesome, awesome work. Just because we have like a really great group of honestly kick-ass women. So I'm just So I'm just like, we're kind of set up to do really well. And I just hope that, you know, like all of our collective enthusiasm and drive and expertise kind of like propels the museum like forward in a really positive way.
Well, from the work that you've done so far, and even just talking with I forget the names of the two other women that were at dinner with us, but even just talking to you guys that night.
It was Melody and Alana.
Melody and Alana. There you go.
Yeah.
I'd say it is. Do you think that's in large part due to Jenny?
I think Jenny has done a really good job, like, of kind of keeping her eyes out and her ears out for, like, young people just generally. I don't think she's
But keeping her eyes peeled for the people who are going to be most effective at the positions that she needs. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So I think she's done a really good job, like, in, just kind of keeping her eyes and ears out, and also, like, looking in the right places, like, you know, job boards that do have people that with museology degrees that are looking for, you know, jobs in museums and things like that. So yeah, I think Jenny's done a really great job of like, you know, casting a wide net that is like it's wide, but it's also specific in how it's going about. Like,
yeah,
you know,
definitely conducive to the
right role.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, it's the biggest goal. And creating the roles for the right people.
Yeah. If you can create a role, go ahead.
Right?
Yeah, why not? World's your oyster.
That's too good. That is all too good. What is, so this is just a fun one. Like you said, in the Whalen Museum, everybody kind of wears many hats usually. Is there any project or thing that you've been given that you kind of looked at and been like, I did not expect to have my toes in this?
I think that kind of goes in like a couple, like I have like two immediate responses to that.
Sure.
So like, I think overall, I didn't expect to have my toes in any of the politics around like killer whales.
Yeah.
And like marine mammals maybe as a whole, but it's this like killer whales are a very touchy topic up here. So I definitely did not expect that. I knew that killer whale, like, you know, just like with all marine mammals, I knew it was going to be slightly political, just because the saying goes is that crazy goes with order, like on the kingdom family, you know. So it's like as soon as you get to like marine mammals, you're at the like top tier of crazy among biologists. And so I think it's just like, that's part of it, right? And I can't imagine what primate people are like, cannot. but yeah, I think it's just like stepping into the like the inherent political nature around these animals. And also like, I don't wanna just say it's politics and just dismiss it. Like, it's politics for a reason, because conservation of animals is so inextricably linked to a lot of our socioeconomic like activities, right? So you wanna think about like slowing down shipping activity. All right, well, there's a price that comes with that, right? You wanna talk about like regulating like whale watching activities. Okay, there's a cost associated with that, right?
Yeah.
It's just like, you wanna talk about like cleaning up the Puget Sound and, you know, enacting like more like strict like chemical or whatever, like there's a cost that's going to come with that, right? And so definitely, like that's why these like marine mammals as a whole, right, are so political, right? Because their environment is so tied to our like socioeconomic activity. It's not just political because people want to be political, okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I didn't expect to kind of like step into that naively. Now I know better. but it's been a really great learning experience, like kind of like how to navigate that, and like also working with like multiple stakeholders, people from like different sectors and things like that, kind of like listening to different perspectives. And then from professionally, the project that I kind of took on was this, it was part of like this NIFWIF project, which was the least cost path modeling project. And before I like really knew much about it, honestly, just like looking at it, I was like, oh, like it's just the least cost path analysis using like this. I did that in one of my like master's classes.
Yeah.
Or whatever, like that's a pretty straightforward analysis. And then kind of like look into it and you're like, oh, this is a lot different than like what it needs to be, what it is. And also it was just like not feasible to do it in ArcGIS, which is how my co-collaborators had like set up the project to like run. And I was kind of like supposed to kind of just like build it up so that it could be applied to the rest of the data set, not just like a year's worth of data. And so what I ended up doing was like I took that whole project and I kind of like translated it, if you will, in R. And that was the first like solo big programming project that I've done. And I hesitate when I talk about it because I still don't feel like its complete funding has like run out for it. And so it's been like shelved. But yeah, it was like the, I knew I was going to step into that. I didn't know what I was going to step into it in the way that I ultimately ended up. And so that was a really, really cool, like fulfilling project that I learned so much from. And I would honestly like hazard to say that it like kind of like motivated me even more to kind of get into this hardcore like spatial ecology realm of like this, like especially like biologging and things like that. And you know, these data are not biologging data. It was still like, I think it was like, it kind of just like opened my eyes like a little more to this like field that I was interested in and dabbling in, I felt like, as a master's student. But then now as like a practitioner, I was just like, yeah, like this is
something you're into.
Yeah.
So going forward, what are the kinds of things that you think you'd like to be doing? Let's say like at the Whale Museum, apart from the Whale Museum, even so, like dealing with like data and ways to analyze it are growing by the day.
Yes.
And I can guarantee you've seen this more than anybody else, especially in the potentials and the realms. Oh, no, no one can. No one can.
Yeah.
But what are the kinds of things you either see yourself doing or that you'd like to
So I kind of have like two little like wish lists in my head. And so like for me personally, my ultimate goal is to go and get a PhD. Like that's going to have to happen because I've always known that even like before taking on like the role that I'm in right now.
Okay.
And yeah, so I'm like currently applying to places and things like that. So we'll see what happens. And then for the Whale Museum, I have a huge wish list of things that I want to do. So it's just like, I mean, first thing first is I really, 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 really want to automate data entry because right now it is manual. And if it's not me that's doing it, it's interns who I want to pay because don't even get started on unpaid internships. But
definitely.
Yeah, I'm not interested in taking on anyone in a volunteer capacity because that, although it opened up doors to me, it honestly did a lot of internal damage that like now as an adult, like I have no idea how much my labor is worth. And so that's just not a good way to set up you know, a college student who's just interested in ecology. No,
definitely.
Yeah.
I respect you a lot for that, by the way. That's.
Yeah. I mean, like I had made a little bit of a caveat to a couple, like I had an intern last winter and she reached out to me and I was like, no, I don't have money for you. And I don't feel comfortable with you working for free for me. And she was like, I'm already going to be here. I'm going to be working at labs and I just want like a few hours to do a project that you might have help with. And I was like, I need to see proof that you're going to be on that. So she was like already going to be here and like really wanted to help. And then in that case, like, I was like, yeah, cool. Okay.
Sure.
Like you can
work, like but... you're set on the other side. You're doing this almost for fun.
Yeah. Exactly. I was like, we'll see you something. This is fun. But okay. It was great for so much. I actually just wrote her a letter of recommendation. She just started college and I just wrote her a letter of recommendation. A summer position that she's awesome. Applying for. So in that one case, like, yeah, I was like, so I just don't want to get called out and like be called like a hypocrite because, but yeah, for most things, I'm not trying to take any unpaid interns. Like,
yeah,
no. Yeah. And so data entry is one thing that is easy for me to delegate out. And I call it as like a data monkey position. And I am frequently that monkey. So it's just, it would be nice if that could be done by a computer and not a person.
That would be awesome.
Yeah. And so I'm kind of trying to figure out how to do that a little bit with our like various different data partners. It's not going to be 100% automated, but if I can get it down to even 50%, that would be great.
Yeah. Cutting the workload in half is huge.
Yes.
It's a big deal.
Yeah. I mean, there's a reason that annual report takes. And honestly, the reason that annual report takes a year is because it takes a year for someone to catch up with a year's worth of sightings data if it's one person entering it. And the pandemic really did a number because we haven't been able to accept like in-person volunteers anymore. And so like historically, Jen, my predecessor, relied heavily on like volunteers through the Whale Museum's like volunteer network that would come in during like the work day, like 9 to 5, and just hang out at a computer for like a couple hours and help her catch up on sightings data. And then the pandemic cut that avenue off. So
yeah,
and that's fine. The pandemic ruined a lot of things more important than this, but and so automating data entry would be like wish list number one. I really want to create some type of like web interface for people to interact with some of the historical data that we have, not in like a raw data format, like, you know, being able to
toggle like trend
map.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Story maps is a really great technology. I want to pull out, like, you know about this, but I want to pull out, like individual animal ID data and like behavioral data out of the comments fields in our like in the database, because
definitely
it would be nice if we can parse those out a little. And so I'm trying to figure out how to do like, it's really hard to do like text pattern recognition, like developing code for that, especially because like people are inherently messy in how they write. So terms like orca or killer whale apply to the same animal. But then within that, you'll get variation based on huge. And so, it would be hard to process like a whole, like 500,000 entries. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Could you hear me?
It would cut out there for a second.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry. I got the connection that was unstable alert. But yeah, easy. I was just saying it's kind of hard to, like, you know, process 500,000 data entries at this point and like be able to like read through the comments and all of them and pick out that information. So trying to figure out how to be able to make that a little more doable programmatically. We have a couple other projects going on like internally. We'll always have Orcamaster, hopefully. We're still working with like Quiet Sound and an Oceanwise and Washington State Ferries and things like that to help. Although, you know, once Quiet Sound got stood up as its own program and their director was hired and things like that, that was a process that took some time. And so now I'm hopeful that, you know, more progress is going to be made in that front.
Lovely.
Yeah, like those are my big like wish list items. Yeah, it's just like a lot of like database cleaning and management. And it's like, it sounds boring, but it's like, it's once interesting, it, and the broader impact of it is going to be really, really great. So,
yeah. Well, not only that too, but once that stuff works well, the amount of things that you can do with clean information that is available quickly is ridiculous. That is,
yeah, that's what I learned. It's like not all data is good data.
That much is absolutely true. With,
yeah,
there was one question that I had for you. Otherwise, hold up. The Orca Master Report, is it publicly available?
So those data are shared with NOAA. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So those data are publicly available. I don't know how you can access them through NOAA. But yeah, if like, because they are federally funded.
Mm-hmm. I am going to go triple check that. All right. Well, we are hitting about an hour, so we'll just wrap it up for now. Is there, I can leave this opportunity to you to plug anything about the Whale Museum, any organizations, any, literally anything you could want, even yourself.
Oh, okay. I don't know. I'm interesting enough to plug. Let's see. So everybody knows, you can just like Google the Whale Museum. You can visit the Whale Museum in person. We are located in Friday Harbor, just up from the ferry landing. Come by. I would have to admit that this time of year is not a pleasant time to visit the San Juans. It's just, you know, not. It's just like gray and cloudy and sometimes rainy. It's just cold.
Yeah.
You can come by in the summer, or you can come by now. It'll be quieter. Whale Museum does close for a little bit in the summer, in the wintertime, though, for like internal, like just a bunch of like, we just do a whole like deep cleaning and inventory of everything.
Definitely.
Let's see. I also want to shout out Doris Duke Conservation Scholars Program. The UW chapter is awesome. I was a mentor this summer for two wonderful interns, Paloma Wood Asimian, who is now a junior at Howard University, and Andrea Pierre, who is now a senior at Pomona College down in Southern California. And they were both wonderful, awesome, two great young women to have for